Do you like books? As a user of the Next Big Idea app, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that you do. And for those of us who love books, their charms are enduring, even in the age of podcasts, streaming series, and addictive social media. The unique appeal of the written word is at the heart of Portable Magic, A History of Books and Their Readers by Emma Smith. Emma is a professor of Shakespeare Studies at Oxford University, and she joins us now to share five of her big ideas.
Hello from Oxford, England. My name's Emma Smith, and I'm absolutely delighted to be on Book Bites talking about my new book, Portable Magic, A History of Books and Their Readers. Let's dive in with the five takeaways that I'd love you to think over from my book. Insight number one, books are a remarkable piece of technology. When we think about books and technology, we're often drawn to think about digital books and e-readers. But books themselves, those objects with turnable pages, articulated from a spine, protected by a cover, they are themselves the most amazing reading hack. Back in the first Christian century, the Roman poet Martius gave a cheeky advert for this new format at the end of a series of poems. "Try them," he says. "They are so much handier than scrolls. They're easier to carry round when you're travelling, and they take only one hand to operate." The book never looked back. And just as we have learned to swipe and pinch screens, so our ancestors, who had been used to scrolling horizontal strips of parchment, animal skin or papyrus, a plant fibre, they had to learn to flick pages, to use their fingers to mark their place in their book, or to rub the corner of the page up in order to be able to turn it. The wonderful thing is that those earliest books are entirely recognisable to us now. If you swapped Portable Magic for the gospel book buried with St. Cuthbert more than a millennium ago, or Gutenberg's first Bibles in the middle of the 15th century, or a first edition of Uncle Tom's Cabin, or the book that's on your nightstand right now, readers across time would be familiar with that artifact and would know how to use it. It's a real moment of connection across the centuries. We sometimes worry that e-books will eclipse paper books, but I think the real issue is how similar these two forms are. E-books are the same size, they're the same format, and they try to produce some of the same experiences, giving you the chance to underline or show how far through the book you are. They sometimes call things like paperwhite, which show their aspirations to be a book. Remember how Pinocchio wanted to be a real boy? Do you think e-books want to be real books? Insight two. You can't always judge a book by its cover. Millions of publishing dollars are spent on book covers each year, although that wasn't a standard part of publication until the second half of the 20th century. You'll have your own favourites. Often that can mean we can hardly bring ourselves to read a new edition of a much-loved title because it doesn't have the right cover. I really find that with the children's books I loved, that they don't have the right cover right now. But sometimes there's a creative mismatch between what the book looks like and what it actually does. In Portable Magic, I enjoyed researching books as gifts, and the history of how books became established as the perfect Christmas gift, just as gift-giving itself was becoming an important part of the holiday. That's in the first decades of the 19th century. Top of the Christmas present wish list were so-called gift books or annuals. These had names like Forget Me Not, or The Garland, or The Gem. They were beautifully produced with coloured silk and satin covers. They were full of poems and engravings. And most importantly, they were marketed as the perfect gift for women. Women could give them to other women. There's a wonderful New York Public Library digitised collection. One of the things that I like so much about browsing online is you can see these quite formal inscriptions from Miss So-and-so to Miss So-and-so as these friendships express themselves through these books. Women could give them to other women, and they were also deemed gifts that a man could give to a woman without immediately having to marry her. Kind of useful. And they became hugely popular. Like all popular books, they created a snootiness. One of the bonehead suitors in George Eliot's novel Middlemarch is shown to be completely hopeless because he believes that a copy of Forget Me Not, one of these annuals, is a suitable present for an intelligent woman. But these books and the women who exchanged them had the last laugh. A series of abolitionist gift books hijacked a format that was thought to be sentimental and harmless, and they used that acceptability and the assumption that the content was going to be bland and apolitical to publicise the moral outrage of slavery and campaign for its abolition. These weaponised gift books were produced by abolitionist groups, including the one in Boston that produced a book called Autographs for Freedom. This looks like a gift book, it circulated like a gift book, and that meant that its revolutionary content could go under the radar. Insight number three, books carry with them an aura that's almost sacred. The first books were Bibles, and that word bibliography, or the French word for library, bibliothèque, make clear that the two words overlap. And in the early years of the Christian era, Christianity and the book develop and spread hand in hand. Although three major religions claim to be religions of the book, printed book technology is most associated with Christianity. The Torah in a synagogue is still in scroll form. The Quran is most often transmitted not through reading a book, but learning its verses by heart. I really enjoyed the fact that when we meet the grizzled Luke Skywalker in the last of the Star Wars films, he's holed up on an island with the precious library of the Jedi scriptures. And we all know what they need to look like. They're old leather-bound books full of blue and gold manuscript writing. That's what a sacred book should look like. Now, most of our books don't carry sacred content. Some are absolutely the opposite of that. But nevertheless, I began to think that all our books have retained some of that sacred aura they had at the very beginning. I think that's why we often find damage to books almost emotionally difficult. It's why burning books, which is not, after all, a very efficient way of destroying them, is such a red button subject. A man on Twitter who cut in half a fat modern novel, a work that existed in hundreds of thousands of editions, so not in itself valuable, he did this in order to have a lighter commute, was more or less put in a sort of police protection program and given a new identity, given the outrage that was expressed to this book murderer. Books do rouse the passions. What's your take, for instance, on people who write in them, or who fold down the corners, or use highlighters, or arrange them on their shelves by colour, or who throw them away after they've finished reading them, or who drop them on the floor or bend their spines? If any of these make you wince, maybe you're thinking subconsciously of those Bibles. Insight four. The form of a book is part of its meaning. You may feel that the book itself, its cover, its paper, its pages, is merely a container for the far more important part, the words, ideas, and information within it. Of course, that's partly true, but only partly. One of the aspects of books I try to explore in Portable Magic is the way their form affects their meaning. I came at this via Shakespeare. When Shakespeare's plays get published after his death in a big formal volume called the First Folio, the publishers are saying something about how they want these works to be received. Instead of the cheap, popular, topical form of the theatre, here we have an expensive book, made to last, made to take up space in a library, made to be studied seriously. It's a work, if you like, rather than a play. Something similar happens to more ordinary books too. Paperbacks were the baby boomers of post-war publishing. Stuffy hardback titles were superseded by modern, cheaper paperback ones. And unsurprisingly, the kinds of works published in paperback were themselves part of new attitudes. Dr. Spock's Baby Care, Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, even Tolkien's The Hobbit. The appeal of these works was partly that the fresh format chimed with their countercultural ideas. There's a reason, after all, that the Beatles never made a song called Hardback Writer. Sometimes this overlap of form and meaning can be taken to wonderful extremes. Ben Denzer is an American book artist. His works are often in book form, and I became preoccupied with his little square yellow book called American Cheese, made of, you guessed it, 20 squares of plastic wrapped cheese. That seems a book in which form, cheese, and meaning, cheese, are identical. But I think what Denzer is actually asking us playfully is, what is a book? What does it mean to devour or consume a book? And is anything that has turning pages and a spine and a cover, which American cheese certainly does, a book? Insight 5. You can never truly get rid of a book. By this, I don't just mean that it's hard for many of us to give away books or thin out our shelves, but it is funny, isn't it, how having lots and lots of books, more than you could ever read in the rest of your life, makes you seem like an intellectual, whereas having more shoes than you can wear, or more cars than you can drive, or a collection of cuddly toys, makes you seem needy or overcompensating. What I mean here, though, is the way books are part of our lives. They are witnesses to particular moments, to friendships, enthusiasms, ambitions, versions of ourselves. And, as forensic science teaches us, every contact leaves a trace. There are projects now harvesting pre-modern DNA from dust in the gutter, the channel between the pages of old books. Readers like us leave part of themselves in the books, just as the books, their ideas and possibilities, rub off on us too. Sometimes this is literal. I love, with a kind of mournful curiosity, reading inscriptions in books in the second-hand shop. Professions of affection, or witnesses to a relationship that is presumably over, otherwise how did these books get to the charity store? They remind us that we all leave our marks on our books, sometimes visible, sometimes invisible. This overlap, this interplay between the human and the book, has a long history, and sometimes a dark one. The flip side of our love of books might be the horrific practice of binding books in human skin. I thought a lot about these volumes and what they say about our overinvestment in books, and perhaps our underinvestment in the dignity of persons. Books and humans have a long and symbiotic history together. Thankfully, we can never really get rid of them. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you do enjoy the book. I'd love to know what you think.
Thank you, Emma. That was Emma Smith with 5 big ideas from Portable Magic, a history of books and their readers. If you like that, you might enjoy our book bite for Index, a history of the, a bookish adventure from medieval manuscripts to the digital age, by Dennis Duncan. I'm Holly Morris. Have an amazing day.